Yeah. Friday Afternoon Deploy is not brought to you by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Funding was not provided by the Carnegie Foundation.
Man, instantly I regret hitting the record button. Sorry. Oh, yeah, normally I wait until my drink is poured and all that stuff. Don't worry, then none of that will make the episode.
That's probably best. That was pretty vulgar.
That was for the best.
That is pushing the envelope. Yeah. Oh,
thanks for joining us, everybody.
Hey.
You just missed things that were
edited out.
Yeah. Welcome to the non-director's cut version of the episode. Man, we're just going to roll into it, you guys. Does that sound good?
Sounds great.
Excellent. We've got Blake couldn't make it. He sent me a message. He said he had a meeting. He had business to take care of.
Talk about JavaScript.
Writing code or something. He's some fucking MongoDB clusters fell down somewhere. I feel bad because, you know, I've been doing like a little bit of a social media push every time a new episode comes out. And I just, that bit about MongoDB was a highlight for me. And so I've beaten Blake like too severely, I feel like. And I'm sorry, Blake, when you hear this, this is my apology, because it's all over Facebook and Instagram and YouTube and Twitter of... I mean, the title of the episode is Blake Shaming, so
that's true.
We love you, Blake.
We love you. Come back. Come back someday.
You didn't have to fake a meeting.
No, you
come and hung out.
You can use a document store for your database if you want to. It's all right. It's okay.
Foreign keys are good.
Yeah. Hey, and so we've got Alex Williams with us as well. What's up, Alex?
Hey, not much.
Blake said hi, by the way.
Oh, hey.
You guys used to work together, right?
Oh yeah, we used to work together. Blake's awesome.
It's a small world here in the Northwest Arkansas dev community. But Alex is working with our team on some projects you're a Rubyist. What would you self describe as from a development perspective? Right. That was a broad question.
As a developer, I describe myself as a full stack developer.
Okay.
Which would include Ruby, JavaScript, HTML, CSS, and maybe some of the extensions on the traditional HTML and CSS, like Sass, Less, Haml, Slim, stuff like that.
Right on. But you're at least a little bit of a polyglot because you're writing Python code for us.
Oh, yeah.
To be into that, right?
I'm fairly self-confident that regardless of the programming language, if you give me at least 2 or 3 weeks, I can learn it and start slinging code.
That's awesome. That's what I've always thought, right? Mm-hmm. Is that the language is a superficial layer on top of the concepts, right?
Right. The hardest part in the beginning is definitely all of the concepts.
Mm-hmm.
After that,
they can be applied to multiple languages, right?
Exactly. Right. But my first programming language was Ruby, and that I consider to be the easiest for me to write.
Right, right. You know it well and best. So I think that we thought it'd be fun to do some. Is it Ruby versus Python? That sounds very adversarial.
I like to think of maybe a family reunion because Alex and I were just talking about how they're both descendants of Smalltalk, and so that's probably where a lot of the similarities come from.
Family reunion, but like a dysfunctional Arkansas family reunion.
Oh, totally, yeah.
You're kind of outnumbered. I was hopeful that that Hayden could join from our team today, but he couldn't. And because Hayden's working on some Ruby projects right now, he's done a lot of Ruby. Tyrell, you might have to be the balancing Ruby voice here.
Yeah, I will reach back into my Ruby days, which were not extensive, but they were good. I enjoyed my time as a Ruby developer.
Maybe that gives you at least in a Ruby kind of VPython, not versus again.
Yeah, but maybe more of a comparison.
Yeah,
it's been a couple months now that I've been writing some Python code.
Right.
So it's given me. Can you hear my mic? Okay.
I can. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. You're good. If you wanna snuggle right up to it though, okay. That's okay.
Yeah, that's fine. Just to give some perspective, maybe some comparisons between being kind of a quote-unquote native Ruby developer,
right,
switching over to Python, since in the developer community, they're so frequently compared as sister languages,
right,
and you can learn this one or you can learn this one, and often, kind of like the high level, what's the difference? People usually say Python's more academic because you can learn it in college,
right,
or it's really popular in the science field.
Yeah, it's like not only used to teach as a teaching language, but also just like really, really widely adopted for scientific and research type backgrounds.
Right. But then coming from Ruby, going into Python, I've definitely noticed a lot of similarities and a lot of differences. I think are pretty interesting.
Yeah. I mean, like for a lot of, compared to a lot of languages, I guess, I mean, both of them stand out as being non-C style languages.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, who has a very common background in web development, where I came through PHP and made it out alive, pretty much, you know, that was my entry point into most programming. I did a little bit of like C and stuff like that, and like basic when I was in school. But like, that's really where that was normal programming, with C-style languages, right? Curly braces,
yeah,
and semicolons. And so Python and Ruby both stood out to me as this very strange thing. You know, even Perl felt more C-like than those two. And so I always saw them as kind of like a weird thing. And it did, because of like writing so many C-style languages and trying them, they did feel like maybe they were something else.
Mm.
You know what I mean?
Well, they look like they look very pseudo-code-ish.
And people called them scripting languages, and so I kind of from the outside was like, "Well, that's a thing that you do for it's some sort of like configuration." I know, I don't agree with it.
Yeah,
for me, it irks me, the wanting to take scripting language from a definition of a language to an insult.
It's definitely become the common, like, if I'm going to dog on Python or Ruby, it's like, oh, that's a scripting language.
It's like, okay.
Yeah.
Well, it's very pejorative when people say it. They don't say it in a good way.
No.
Yeah, exactly.
Fuck you too, buddy.
Yeah. I guess that comes from, you know, like, I know Python, you know, I guess what kind of made sense to me for that was that it was already there on, like, Linux servers, you know? So, like, well, that makes sense just to learn how to use it. And I guess that's kind of where the scripting description comes from, maybe, is because it was used to accomplish server-side tasks.
Yeah, it was like glue, like little automation things, and it was a way to bolt two systems together in the same way that kind of Perl was.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, Perl was a little bit more internet aware than its like contemporaries.
But definitely, yeah.
So I think it'd be fun, you know, to explore. I haven't done a lot of Ruby, so someone else is gonna have to talk about Ruby syntax and things like that. I can go.
Allow me.
Yeah.
I would say probably the first thing that I notice as kind of being a big difference between Ruby and Python is the fundamental idea behind it.
Okay.
Python, I learned, has an import this.
Right. The Zen of Python.
The Zen of Python.
Yep.
And I just like the first couple of lines here: beautiful is better than ugly, explicit is better than implicit, simple is better than complex. And I think for Ruby, those are the same, except for explicit is better than implicit.
Oh, totally.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Ruby is all about
convention over configuration.
Yes,
and those kind of things. That's a Rails thing.
It's a Rails thing, but Ruby certainly, one of the core factors or one of the core features of Ruby is metaprogramming and DSLs and making syntax very conform to the developer and not the developer to the syntax, For example, Ruby has for loops in them. Nobody uses them. But if you were a C developer and you walked into Ruby, you would feel at home because you could just write a for loop and it'd be fine. But that doesn't always lead to the most explicit or easy to understand code because it's kind of all about the developer's style.
That's what I always felt about Ruby.
Yeah. I've probably said it on the podcast, but I think a very accurate description of Ruby is it's a very vain language.
Yes, definitely.
And it's like it allows your vanity. It allows you to kind of become a bit of a, have your own personality.
That's what I always thought. Whenever I was looking at someone's Ruby code, I always felt like I was digging through their dot files.
Yeah. You know, it's, yeah. Like, well, and Ruby developers are also dot files hoarders. My dot files are based off of Zach Holman's, who is a Ruby developer for GitHub, whose dot files are based off of Ryan Bates, who is the guy who made Railscast.
But it also feels very personal to me, like in that way. Like somewhere between digging through your dot files and your like fucking Undie drawer or something like that.
Yeah. Oh, for sure.
It's very personal.
That is certainly one thing I appreciate about Python is there's the, how do you say, the Pythonic way to do things.
Yeah.
So there's a correct way to do it, and you can be judged based on a sort of standard. Whereas in Ruby, the intent of Matsumoto was to make a language that anybody could write however they wanted, just as long as they were cool with it. But the Ruby community is certainly developed in a way that depending on the shop that you're in, they can have their own set of styles. And if your styles don't match their styles, there can be conflict. And you can be judged based on stylistic differences.
Right.
And you have things like style guides.
And you like, because you can do so much metaprogramming, like that can like be translated not just into like style and how we do it here, but actual like productivity problems of like, how do I get the code to do what it needs to do?
Right.
I have to understand the conventions that you've put in here that are potentially beyond the language and the framework, and then actually a convention within that project. True. Not just a design pattern. Right.
Right. But I think one of the intentions that a lot of programmers miss when walking into a Ruby project or a Rails project is you aren't supposed to understand necessarily how everything works. You don't have to.
Right.
If the person designing the program did a good job, you should be able to understand what it's doing without having to understand how. And I feel
because it's descriptive and declarative,
right?
Or,
because it's very because it's very descriptive,
right?
And you should be able to make your changes or add features without having to understand the whole code base or understand how everything is working. It should be very intuitive.
Right. I mean, I see that being true of any code base that's written to be modular, right?
Yeah.
Like if you have a proper separation of concerns, then it should be, in theory, easy to like have your logic encapsulated and not touch other things. And no doubt, like, a language's design and the features of that language can lend itself to that, right? And Python, I don't know if I can say that the same about Python. It's not that you can't write code that way, or that there isn't plenty of code written that way.
I mean, and it's encouraged to be like descriptive, you know, with your variables.
Yeah.
And such, you know, so that you kind of write it where it's almost self-commenting. The best that you can, this function, you know, do this and you know what this is.
That said, I feel like you hear in the Python community less shit like, oh, your code should be, you don't need documentation because you have self-documenting code. That's not really something you hear out of the Python community. Like it can be descriptive and intuitive and it can read in an intuitive way. But it's also fucking full of doc strings.
Totally.
And like really good
doc. Like gripes at you if you don't have doc strings for your class, for every method on your class.
If anyone's not a Python developer, doc string is just a comment at the top level of any defined Python object method function.
It's technically a multi-lined comment.
Yeah. But like the language, and I learned this at FayettePy last night. I didn't know that when Chrissy was giving beginner tips. that there's a built-in in Python called help. There's a help function.
Yeah.
That all it does is like pull the doc strings for you. So yeah. I've used them as a developer reading the code, but they're actually tools in the language that will pull those doc strings and use in place. I know that like there are documentation builders that would pull it, but there's other stuff in there. And so,
I wonder, it's not just a convention.
Yeah, exactly. Right. I think IPython probably does. Yeah. You know, you can do like the question mark or double question mark on a symbol.
It's got to be an alias, right?
It's doing that and like some extra syntax highlighting. But yeah, it's not just a convention that you put a multi-line comment at the top. It's actually a feature of the language. And there's like a whole system of tests that you can do, doc tests, where you can actually write logical tests in the doc string. Nobody ever uses that shit. Has anybody ever written doc tests for Python?
No.
Nope.
But it's totally a thing.
I didn't know it was a thing.
You can write like assertions in the doc strings of your tests and actually run. I love that you didn't know this.
Yeah.
I'm not in like a judgmental way.
Everyone could see the confused look on my face. I need to test my doc strings.
I just love that it's like such a relic, like in the back corner of the Python room that like, cause no one uses it. They really don't.
Right. I've never seen it,
but it's totally a thing. You can do, there's even like doc test support within Django in the framework. Just no one fucking does.
How to double the tests in your test suite?
Exactly. Yeah, like every
time my runtime's too fast.
Pylint's making me write doc strings. I might as well throw an assertion in there while I'm at it.
There's some unit tests in my doc strings.
Yeah. See, and I think you kind of hit on it in a lot of ways. You mentioned the community and like the value of it. Like that's where a lot of the culture around Ruby and Rails really encourages that. I mean, there's definitely tooling that helps perpetuate that, like the method chaining and like the emphasis on writing, you know, almost like sentences. And so you take out the things that break the flow of your reading, and then you add features that allow it to read more like a sentence, like having a question mark for Boolean stuff.
And things like that make it
very readable.
I'm triggered. That one always weirded me out. Like, it's not a feature of the language at all, right? That is totally a convention. Am I right? Or does the language do things if you end your variable with a question mark? I always thought that was just, am I describing it correctly?
It's just that, method names can have suffixes with a question mark.
Okay.
There's nothing in the language that asserts something based on there being a question mark or an exclamation part, because exclamation marks can also be at the end of method names.
Okay.
And so the community has kind of designed guidelines around what these are supposed to do.
So it's a convention.
It's not a language feature in that it asserts anything based on
only that the language allows for it.
Yeah. So it sounds kind of like type hinting in Python, right? Because I can put a dash and an arrow and then like none if this isn't going to return anything.
And Python doesn't actually do anything to compile or test that your turn.
Totally ignores it, but it's just there for the developer to quickly look and see what this might be returning.
Except that type hinting will let you indicate many types. The convention for a question mark, is that it returns a Boolean.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
Yes.
What is the convention for an exclamation point?
People argue over this.
Means your code is very imperative.
Right. So
I'm yelling in my code.
So I would say the majority would say if you have an exclamation mark, one, it implies that there is a duplicate function of the same name without the question mark.
Okay.
And the question mark will do something destructive that the method without the question mark will not do. And this And in the Ruby standard library, there are methods that have an exclamation point and duplicates that don't. For example, I believe it's I think it's delete if on numerable. So if you have an array and you do delete if, then you give it an expression that returns true or false, and it'll get rid of all the, it'll give you a new array.
It's a filter. Yeah. Okay.
Right. It'll give you a new array. Right. But it doesn't affect any of the original items. It creates a new array.
So if you use
the method with an exclamation point,
you do delete if
actually,
and then it modifies the original. So it's in that case, it's kind of a pass by reference, or is it actually making a duplication, a copy? Right.
You're right.
Okay. That's cool. Mm-hmm. I think.
Yeah.
alien to me because you can't put punctuation in this in like any sort of symbol names in Python or a lot of other languages.
Yeah, variable declarations
except for PHP, in which everything has to start with a symbol. Yeah, dollar sign.
And those are the conventions that I love about Ruby, and I've kind of tried to bring into my style of Python. Not that I'm trying to like get question marks or exclamation points or things, but like the ability to know that this is a destructive method. Like that's hugely important.
I propose that we do this. I mean, it's purely convention, right? We just have to use the syntax available to us. And I think we should end those methods with like double underscore heyo. And the number of O's indicates level of destruction. You know, that's like, heyo with four O's is like, you know, dash VVV, like extremely verbose, you know?
Yeah.
Like,
right.
Heyo.
Three O's, I'm going to destroy like two ancestors to like, this. Like,
That's the depth of recursion of the destruction.
Once you get to five, it's deleting stuff at the database.
That's good. Yeah.
Like all your persistent data is now gone.
Yeah.
And reaching out across.
But I mean, you know, like that's kind of the difference, right? Is there's nothing fundamentally that you couldn't do in Python that you can do in Ruby, except that in Ruby they let you do it with symbols and there's conventions that do it in a much more condensed way. Mm-hmm. Right. But like a good example of something like that is prefixing methods and functions with an underscore in Python.
Mm. Yeah.
So a single underscore is purely a convention. The language does nothing to stop you from...
Yeah, there's no such thing as private
changes
methods.
Nothing, right. But it's an indication that it's a private or...
Right.
Not even really private, right? Because it doesn't have the properties of a private method. That method can be called anywhere.
Right.
But it's kind of an indication, like, if you're digging around in a library and you find a method you want to use and it starts with an underscore, it's like, hey, buddy, you shouldn't be in here messing with this. Like, this is subject to change. It's not a public API.
Right.
It's not really about like protecting access to data or state. It's much more about like protecting the. We reserve the right to nuke this method from orbit at any moment. So you shouldn't be fiddling with it. You know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Ruby certainly makes a distinction between that, as they have private and a private keyword, and less oftenly used a protected keyword.
Right.
And the private does what you would expect, and the protected just allows access to those methods in the subclasses. Mm-hmm.
I think that's how protected works in Java too.
Am I right? I think so. Right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah.
No, and that's what I remember about public and protected from Java is that or private and protected is that private does what you expect it to do, and protected is the thing that no one uses. That's the thing you never see, but it's there.
That's about how it works.
Yeah.
Private needs setters and getters.
That's right. Yeah. And protected needs you to finish your homework because you're in CS 101.
Yeah. And so we.
I've never written actual enterprise. Like, there's some Java dev somewhere fucking wandered onto the show and is lost. And is like, fuck that guy. Never get through a code review here at Megacorp.
Yeah, probably not.
You're right.
Yeah. The most I've done is, you know, I've tinkered with Spring Boot to wander down the Java path a little bit, but you know, we try to respect that in Python, like with the, it's, I guess really the convention is like a dunder dash or whatever, like
double underscore.
Yeah.
Well, if it's double underscore before and after, can you define those yourself, or are those that might be reserved by the
but you do like a double underscore at the beginning. I think is like the actual Pepe convention.
Oh, really?
For that,
for private?
Yeah.
I thought it was just single underscore.
I've only ever done single.
Mm. Oh, man. We don't even know our own convention.
Yeah.
That's why we need
really
obvious stuff.
So the really like anal retentive way to write properties, I guess, on a class in Python would be to, here's my property, self dot double underscore my property. And then you have at property name, which is a method, and then that just returns the I'm using air quotes, the private property. And then you do a decorator at my property name dot setter, and then it's a method with the property name, and then that takes the value and that would be your setter on the, again, air quotes, private
right
property.
We're setters and getters, y'all. It's thick in here.
I'm sorry.
We're way down.
You know what happened?
Way down.
I brought up Java.
You know it's bad when you're
Java
setters and
getters. Oh, no. Why? You brought up. Oh, God. It's got real thick. He's looking at Java.
No. I've got some Python info in front of us here on the use of underscores. This is nothing from the actual Python docs. Okay. So this is editorial.
Me and Tosh, who will be on this show, I suppose sometime. I never met him in person, but he and I had this debate and this
yeah
about this.
We'll record that episode March 8th. I'm gonna go down there. We're gonna do it somewhere off of Seven Mile Beach in Grand Cayman. And it'll air the Friday after that. So like mid March, we'll get a month here. We'll let you guys over the wire debate it. But so the single underscore, here's something I didn't know. In a Python interpreter, single underscore references the result of the last executed statement. Only in an interpreter.
Yeah, yeah. Ruby's the same.
I didn't know that. I never use it.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I do that all the time for when I'm playing around in a terminal.
Had no idea. Huh. So if you're playing around in a terminal, underscore is automatically referencing the result of the last execution. Not in your only in an interpreter when you're in there. This is something that's important. I forgot about entirely as a convention. This gets used a lot in Django and just general Python. If you use underscore in your actual code to reference a variable, that is a convention that the variable intends to be not used, just thrown away.
Yeah.
So like there are things like the enumerate function, which will take like an iterable of some type.
An enumerator.
You'll get like the index of the object and then you'll get the object itself. And if you want to like enumerate it and get the index numbers but not actually use the object, you might do like for index, comma, underscore.
Yeah.
And so that's not touched. Yeah.
I've seen that pattern used a lot in Golang.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Because a lot of the functions return two arguments.
Yeah. A whole lot.
A whole lot. And it'll usually be the result that you expect.
or the error.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so
you can just assume if you've got two things or the second thing, you've blown something up.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Thing, so comma, error.
Yep. Exactly.
You see it a lot in Django with, there's like one specific thing that's all over the docs. It's on a get or create,
yep,
which on the ORM will return an object from the database. It returns a tuple of the object from the database and whether or not it was created.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you can tell if it existed or if it was just created. And so all the time you'll see, you know, item, comma, underscore equals get or create, because we don't care if it was created in that particular case. That happens a lot. So confirmed by this random person on the internet, not official documentation. Single underscore indicates private in Python. Double underscore, you're right, Alan. I had no idea about this.
Mangling, right?
Yeah, mangling. It has a specific meaning to the interpreter. Python mangles these names. It's used to avoid name clashes with names defined by subclasses. So that's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Had no idea.
Yep. It's pretty cool.
Internationalization. That's very common, at least in Django and some other places. You import the method that does translation of a string as underscore. They rename it to underscore instead of like you get text lazy or something like that.
Okay.
Just so that you can quickly wrap it around strings with a one character function call for making all your stuff translatable. So that's another standard.
Yeah, you get that underscore and then, parentheses.
So most of that is purely convention, except the double underscore thing. That I didn't know. That actually means something to the Python interpreter, though I rarely see it.
Yeah,
I see dunder, which is double underscore before and after, which are built-ins in Python, and usually are describing some sort of private method of a type, right? So like a list will have a double underscore or a dunder iter, which is the iteration method internally.
And a class can too.
And all objects have call. Yeah. So if it's callable, you can take an object that's not callable and make that fucker callable. You can turn an integer into a function by by adding a double underscore call method to it, that's one of the crazy things about Python metaprogramming is all the stuff you can do with the dunder methods.
Yeah.
That's how you do operator overloading. But that's also how you do crazy shit. Like every time you call this function, make it like have some side effect by overriding the call method, or like drop a fucking argument every time it gets called. You can do weird stuff. Mm-hmm. You could, If you could just hide out in Python code and fiddle with some of those objects, you could really mess with people's heads.
Interesting. So one thing about Ruby metaprogramming that I don't really see an equivalent for in Python, unless you could somehow do it with this dunder call method, are these hook methods called, they've got included, extended, and inherited.
Okay.
So let's say you make a base class, and then you make a subclass and you inherit from the base class. In the base class, you could define an inherited method. And as an argument, the subclass will be passed into that function as the first argument, and you can do whatever you want.
So it's like a lifecycle hook, like the base class is receiving an event that it was subclass?
No, like when the file with the subclass definition gets read,
uh-huh,
and it sees like, oh, this class inherits from this base class, that subclass class object will be passed into the inherited function will be called on the base class at that moment. And you can do things.
So it's like, it's a way of, I mean, it's hooks. They're hooking together.
It's a hook.
So the base class can update its internal state to say, hey, I have a new child class that
I
need.
You could
to be
do whatever you
with.
Want. You could make a list of certain classes. You could, check the type of the subclass and be like, mm-hmm, if any subclass that has this type of property defined on it gets inherited by me, then I want to do something. Or a lot of frameworks and libraries will use it so that when you inherit from it, they can then extend other modules onto your subclass. So you're inheriting from this one base class, but then it includes a whole bunch of other stuff on the fly.
There's stuff that I don't know how there are probably multiple patterns for it, because stuff like this happens in Python and I'm thinking about in Django, like at the model level, there's a lot of stuff there. There's like a contribute to class method that I'm not exactly what it does under the hood. You don't really mess with it much, but
right.
So like, Alan, I see your wheels turning of like, where would I use that? I'm thinking of a good example is like, imagine if you had, you've got in Django's internals, you've got the base model class.
Mm-hmm.
And like within your app, the Django needs to do shit with all of the models. Now, it has a model registration system, so like, bear with me here, but like,
sure.
Imagine if the model subclass had a method on it that was getting called every time a subclass was loaded, and basically on that subclass you had a property which was a list of all of the unique types of subclasses. Like, there's a car and there's a book and there's a, you know, like all of that's happening at the model like class level. It's basically just keeping a registry. If you've ever built a registry pattern, that's where I see this being useful.
Yeah.
If you've ever put some like global, you know, like state, like some sort of global list, and every time someone like, you know, wants to hook in, remember when we did like data pipelines, right?
Mm-hmm.
I need to hook some step into the pipeline. Mm-hmm. So you go import this list and append something to it. Mm. You could do this by just say, hey, by subclassing it, some other chunk of the code will know to execute something on your class it registers.
Well,
So that's pretty cool.
I don't think that's cool.
So in Python, like what I just described is an example of how you would kind of roll your own pattern like that. There's nothing built into the language for it that I know of.
I was thinking of just abusing init.
Oh, totally.
That's thinking about how I would accomplish something like that, just overriding
init just being the constructor. But that's what I would do, is I would put it in the init constructor, and so all the subclasses, you know, could inherit from that and call the parent method, but it takes an argument of self, so the parent method can do some introspection and like, hey, what am I? The class says as it's constructed, you know, like, what is my type?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Type of self.
Right. Yeah. And do something based on that. But and, not as easy to do.
Yeah. And that's one area where I've seen it be very different, because there's more hooks and things of that nature in Ruby and Rails. Whereas Django is just like, why don't you just jump back here in the code, bruh? Just like, Python's just like, Just go do it. It's cool. Whatever.
Do whatever you need to do.
You want to do some stuff on the save? Just override the save. No big deal.
Whereas it would be
like before save or after save.
Right.
Whereas with Django, it's just like, it's save, man.
Yeah.
You've now overwritten save and done this stuff here.
Yeah. Make sure you can override save. Make sure you keep saving when you do it.
Yeah.
If you want to do something before save, do it before you save.
Right.
And if you want to do something after save, do it after you save.
Yeah.
You know.
Django does something on a view, because there's like the created There's a creative method that like it tries to do that where you don't have to override save if you didn't want to.
There is actually a post save and a pre save.
Yeah. Those are the ones I'm thinking about.
Especially the Django REST framework.
Yeah.
Because there's some stuff that like has to be considered, particularly around saving data in a relational database. Mm-hmm. If you're doing anything with related objects, an object has to have a primary key.
Yep.
Before you can use that primary key in another related object. So if you've got a foreign key, the thing that you're referencing in the foreign key has to have a row written first. So you have mm-hmm. to be able to basically go save it, and then after save it, now reference the database has assigned a primary key, and now that can be used to finish. So there's like, and there's also like a post save like mini to me. The cool thing about most frameworks is a lot of that stuff you never actually mess with that. And if you're in Django and you're fucking with that stuff, like stop for a minute.
Yeah,
think about reevaluate.
There might be a real reason, but there's a really good chance that you have gone too far down some rabbit hole if you're doing that.
Yeah, certainly a lot of hesitation. Anytime you reach for the pre-save or before save, after save, those are definitely red flags. Don't use these methods unless the project doesn't matter, I guess. If you're just like some play project. Yeah.
I'm curious, in Ruby, what do you have that is analogous to some of the like iterable composition tools you have in Python, like comprehensions? List comprehensions, right?
Oh, yeah.
And so a list comprehension is a way of you can assign a list to a variable, but that list is generated in the assignment, if that makes sense. So I could say...
So it's like a one-liner. It's almost like a list.
It's a list with a for loop written in it, and that for loop is yielding items into the resulting list. So you can say
you can throw an if in there. Too,
yeah, you can do an if, so you can fill. Yep. You can do nested loops. You can do any one liner executable in there, and you can also you can run some callable on the things that are being yielded by the loop, and actually do some filtering or post processing. So my list equals, and then what looks like an array. Mm-hmm. But it's X for item and blah, and it's basically copying or something like that.
Yeah,
and you can do the same thing with dictionaries, which are like what's the dictionary called in other languages?
Hash table.
Same thing with hashes with keys and values.
Yep. So I didn't encounter list comprehension until I learned CoffeeScript. I was programming when that came out.
I didn't know that CoffeeScript. Loved list comprehension.
Oh, yeah. I didn't either.
Yeah. I used to think that CoffeeScript was the Ruby-esque version of JavaScript, but now I think it's more of the Python-esque version.
Okay, hang on. Sorry.
See, I would have said the same thing. Like CoffeeScript.
Hold your thought, because I don't want to derail you, but Blake is a CoffeeScript fan. Am I right about that? Or is he a TypeScript fan?
He's a TypeScript fan.
Oh, never mind. Yeah, I love
CoffeeScript. For a minute, I was like, hey, we're even closer to winning him over to our side than I ever thought.
No, TypeScript is like Golang.
Right. It's statically typed.
It's like, JavaScript is just so terrible.
People want
types so they feel better about themselves as they're writing it.
Welcome to the show. You found your home, Alex. Yeah.
It's fine. Don't get me wrong. I love JavaScript in what it can do, but
I love it in my browser.
Yeah, but it is a bad language. Just as English is the global language and English is terrible.
It doesn't mean it isn't offensive on the ears. Right?
Yeah. I think it's kind of like the crazy hot date that will slash the tires to your car is JavaScript.
That's JavaScript.
Yeah.
There's upside, but like with great risk.
I like to think, and this will sound super pejorative, but I mean, we're kind of here, so why not? I think of TypeScript as JavaScript with a babysitter. Okay. Like it kind of keeps, it gives it good boundaries. It keeps you from getting out of hand because, I mean, JavaScript.
I thought of it more like very powerful. JavaScript with a parole officer.
I like that. Yeah.
Just checking in on you, buddy.
Right. Okay, hold on. So list comprehensions.
Yes. Thank you.
No, it's great. JavaScript.
Also, thank you for recovering the tangent.
So basically, a list comprehension is like an array with a for loop in it, but it's like a ternary operator.
Right.
Right.
So in Ruby, there's a there's no list comprehensions, but there's a module called enumerable, and it's included in your It's included in some of the base classes like array and hash. And so you can call methods on these objects like select and reduce and delete if.
Gotcha.
And find. And then if you create your own custom class, you can also include enumerable and then you get all the same things.
Got it. That. So you've got like almost like a, well, it's kind of like Python. A lot of its primitive types have, I don't think it's built necessarily this way on the hood, but you can think of it almost like they're called iterables.
Yeah.
And it's like a mix in almost.
Right.
Right. They have the common properties of like an iterable type does not exist.
Right.
But there are many types that have the common properties of an iterable. Like,
can't you define like a double underscore iter something double underscore method on an object in Python and that'll make it iterable?
Does it make it iterable or okay?
Again, that reminded me a lot of.
So like when you do for foo and bar, it's calling bar dot iter and having a yield, and you have to. It's there's you have to define iter, but that has to be defined as a generator, right? It has to.
I believe so.
Values.
Yeah, yeah. I know it functions. You know, because you have the dot underscore dict. Too, which I abuse all the time in my iTerminal, my Python terminal.
It's just like a brute force serialization like, to a hash map.
What properties does this thing have? And I especially use it in the Django ORM. Like, what does this guy have anyway? Especially if I didn't make the models myself, then I can just call dot dict on it and get a nice little dictionary of everything.
Yeah. I would say list comprehensions are one of the nicest parts about Python. I like it.
I dig them. You can abuse them.
Yeah, you can.
Yeah. It seems, though, because for the most part they're one-liners, if it becomes anything crazy, it becomes unmanageable. And so it's a nice yellow flag to say, like, hey, you need to pull it back. Whereas in Ruby, you make a block. You give a block to these methods, and they can easily be several lines long, and they can be pretty unmanageable. And you're like, well, do you really have a block of code here, or do you have a method or a class or something, right?
That's kind of what I assume maybe the PEP 8 like line length and why it's so ridiculous. Maybe that's
80 characters.
Yeah.
It's the one rule supposed to rein in no one cares
our list
about.
Comprehensions that, you know, like, oh no, that's
cut that
but
out.
If you, if you look at like the methods on the Ruby array, there's, not including enumerable, there's something like 30 methods.
Okay.
And in Python, there's only like 6 or 7.
Python's got 6 or 7, but what it does, what it has is in the standard library, beyond the standard library, these aren't like things you import, like just built-in methods in the interpreter, that there are a bunch of them that are just manipulators for iterables. So you have map and reduce.
Right.
So you don't have list.reduce. Yeah. You just have a reduce function that you pass a list into and things like that. So you have, you have length. Mm. Yeah. So a list does not have a length. Rather, there's a list, a length function that you pass a list into.
I'm glad you bring both of those up because the length and the map I found both frustrating. The length function is I don't immediately have a problem with it. I think it's cool that you kind of break out the length and the count function.
Right. Mm.
In Ruby, it's a little dumb. There, it's one function.
Right.
If you pass it no arguments, you get the length of the array. If you pass it an argument, it counts
how many instances exist.
Exactly. So that's one thing.
Actually, the other thing is, though, that like if you're going to actually count stuff in Python, there's a different thing in the standard library called the collections module, which has way more like computationally efficient ways of doing counting and like aggregations on stuff in this. So you really, I rarely see when it actually used the count function in Python.
Gotcha.
It's almost it's a vestigial tail as far as I can tell.
Gotcha. Yeah,
do you ever use it?
Count. Yeah,
yeah.
I do. Sometimes.
Sorry.
The map.
No, it's cool. It's cool.
Map though, I don't find very useful in Python.
Map.
Because it's so difficult to do multi-liner computations with map. So if it's more than a one-liner, then I'm not going to use it.
It's true. It doesn't save you a whole lot of time. I mean, map is not really any different than a list comprehension in which you're passing the item being yielded from a for loop into a function.
Right. It's more of a stylistic thing. It's you're either going to use map or you're going to use a list comprehension, but it's only going to be on one line.
The thing about a list comprehension is like map Map can be used if you're intending to do it in place. The list comprehension is returning a result. And I think, does map return a list, or does map operate on the list?
Both. Okay. You can do both. Okay. I mean, it does return a list, but it also does operations on it.
On the thing, yeah. So it probably is mostly stylistic. It's just, you can't have a reduce function and not have a map function, though.
That's true.
How are you going to get that sweet, sweet Google architecture without map and reduce?
I've never used map, I don't think, in Python. I've used it in JavaScript.
Yeah.
Do
you even Hadoop, bro?
No, I do not.
What's the other one? There's one that I always forget its utility until I need it, and then I go dig it up. But there's a zip function in Python.
Oh, yeah,
zip. What does zip do? Zip, someone remind me.
Yeah, zip, you can... what is it? You can take multiple arrays and call zip on them, and...
Yeah.
It doesn't flatten them. It's kind
of... I'm going to use the new help function that I found out in the interpreter, because the doc strings on the built-ins in Python are pretty good. Next method returns a tuple or the ith element. Oh Lord, I've had too much. I've been drinking gin. It's giving me the most complicated explanation possible. Tell the shortest interval. It's basically working through all the items in a list, passing the result of an operation into the next operation. So you can like zip a list of numbers and with the function add them all together. So it's a way to work through an interval in like an order one way and kind of compound the answers. Mm. So
if I wanted to add one to every item in the iterable?
Well, you wouldn't want to. It'd be more like if you wanted to do like the Fibonacci sequence. So I need to know the result of the last operation to compute the next one. Gotcha. And so it's passing it's compounding. Am I getting that right? This is my very quick while the mics are hot reading of the documentation that's very convoluted in the interpreter, so I might have that totally wrong. It's totally useful. Every once in a while I find a use for it, and I'm very proud of myself.
Mm. In Ruby, when you do zip, you take you need like one or at least you need at least two arrays, and it essentially merges all of the items into multiple arrays. So if you have three arrays and you call zip on them, then you will get an array of three arrays. And the items, it'll be like the zero index of the first array will be the zero index of the first array inside of the new one. And then the first index of the second, or zero index of the second array will be the second item in the first array.
Totally. Yeah. I've got this wrong.
Yeah, so zip in Python does that as well, actually.
Gotcha. Yeah. I've got zip wrong. I'm looking at it now with actual examples, and I just totally misread that. Yep. But you can use zip in unique ways paired with other functions. There's another function that does what I'm talking about that basically compounds the results as it moves through the array. But it's one of the ones that... Whatever one I'm thinking of is one kind of like map that takes a list and a callable and then applies the callable to each item in the list.
Oh, yeah.
But also sends to that callable an argument, which was like the last result. So you can like, you know, you use it for like parallelizing operations.
Okay.
You can use it with like multiprocessing, like go compute a bunch of things, and when they're all done, compile the results. Mm-hmm. Kind of like reduce, I guess.
Yeah.
That's really similar what reduce to reduce. Does. Yeah. But that's pretty cool. You mentioned something we got to talk about because it's something that's always confused me about Ruby syntax. And it's a very interesting thing that I don't think there's any analog for in any other language I've seen, which is a block.
Yeah.
Let's talk about blocks.
Yeah. Yes, definitely.
Tell me what a block is. And I've used them, but like in your words as someone who actually maybe understands them.
Yes.
I know them from Vagrant.
Right. Like
that's pretty much it. What is this
from
thing?
Vagrant files? Yeah, yeah, totally.
Yes. If you are a beginner Ruby programmer and you want to go interview for a job, you 100% have to know the difference between a proc, a block, and a lambda. These are they're all very similar concepts, but they have different functions. Not super important in everyday coding, but they do. And people
super
like to test
important
you
all in pretentious coding
exactly.
interviews.
Yes, definitely.
I definitely
and
got.
And I have been asked.
I got the explain me the proc file.
It's
the built in Ruby. It's the FizzBuzz built into the syntax of Ruby. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So a proc is kind of like a JavaScript function. It can you can define as many arguments as you want in the definition of it. But when you call it, you can pass zero or more arguments to it, and it doesn't care. It'll execute the function regardless. It won't throw a syntax error if you don't. If you do a lambda, then you have to pass in the explicit number of arguments. So it works like a method on any other thing, on any other programming language. A block is a piece of code that you can pass around, and it only gets executed when it gets evaluated. What makes a block so useful as opposed to a lambda or something else, there is a yield keyword in Ruby that's different from the yield keyword in Python. A yield, when you say yield inside of a method, it essentially says, I want this method to take a block.
Right.
And whatever code gets written here will, whatever, when you call this method, you can attach a block to it. And the return value of that block will be inserted into this yield right here. So you can assign a variable to it.
It's another form of hook, right?
Yes, it's another form of hook.
Take your own code and insert it into this method, and specifically like in the middle of the method, not before it's called, not after it's called, like you would use.
You can do it. You can put yield anywhere. You could put it at the beginning or at the end. But
you could also like yield into a function call. Right?
Exactly.
That could be an argument into a function that's being called.
That's interesting. It kind of reminds me of like a Jinja macro.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, kind of.
Now, also in a function definition, a common pattern is you may have like def thing, open parens, variable, my first variable, and then you would have like your arguments, args equals hash, and then you would have an ampersand block.
Okay.
And that you would call just the same as with yield, but instead of the value of the block being put into the yield and it being executed in the yield, instead the block is passed almost like a lambda to that argument.
Yeah, kind of like now, a closure.
Yeah, like a closure. Right? Yeah. So you can you could call it, it doesn't get called immediately there. It's an argument that's been passed. So you can then do dot call and pass in whatever arguments you want to it at any point, or you can just pass it on to another function for later use. And those are kind of the main things. People love blocks in Ruby, and I do as well, because they look really pretty.
Right.
And they give you a lot of flexibility. Lambdas and procs aren't so much. Lambdas are more, I found myself in Ruby using lambdas when I wanted to have a hash or a dictionary with a key that had some kind of small functionality. Or maybe I had a, maybe I'd have a dictionary with some keys in the inside the lambdas. You would cast whatever was passed to them into a different type. This one will cast you to an integer, and this one to an array, or my custom type, whatever.
Gotcha.
But then blocks you can use anywhere, and especially the Rails framework uses blocks a lot.
It's really interesting. I was looking over Hayden's shoulder when he was working on kind of his recent project, and the backend's all in Rails, and I was kind of helping debug something, and I was looking at blocks, and I was like, my brain hurt a little bit trying to wrap my head around it. And then I was like, oh, that's cool. And then I thought about it, and I was like, what is the analog in Python? And I don't think there is one.
I don't think so.
I don't think there's anything like that in Python. You have lambdas, right?
But, yeah, but lambdas, we never use those, though, and they're frowned upon.
Every once in a while, like, there are things like the sort method on an array, which you need to pass it some callable that it calls on each item to determine how to sort it. So it has to yield some integer value. It's convenient to use a lambda there rather than like writing a function definition and then passing it in, just to do it as a one liner. It's the same thing as like a list comprehension. There's nothing there that is computationally advantageous. It's purely syntactic sugar to condense it all into one place and say, you know, like, but nothing stops you in those cases, because you can, any callable will work, right? For those built in methods, you can go import some function from somewhere else. But you can write an inline lambda if it's just, you know, multiply everything by two or take the absolute value or something like that, you know. But nothing like blocks in Python, as far as I know.
Yeah. Is there anything like args and quargs in Ruby?
Args, but not quargs. No.
Okay.
No.
I did find that one strange when I came into Python.
Yeah.
Args and quargs is weird. I think it's unique to Python. Does Go have something like that? Surely not. No,
I don't. I don't think so.
I think most of them have args, not the quarks. And all it is just this. This will be an array of arguments.
It just takes all of the positional arguments and rolls them up into one list object for you, and then it takes all named arguments and rolls them up into a dictionary for you.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Then you can do cool shit with the asterisk operator, which goes the other direction. Mm-hmm. It turns a list into positional arguments, and double asterisk, which turns a dictionary into
keyword arguments.
When you say quarks in a method definition and one variable name, then that means when you call the function, you can pass as many arguments to it as you want, and that'll all get compiled into a single list. Is that right?
If you do asterisk args in the method definition, you can pass any number of positional arguments into it, so just values.
Right, right.
And that will get rolled up into a list.
Yeah, Ruby does that.
Okay, quarks with double asterisks, these are named arguments. So you would call the function and say foo equals bar and ABC equals 1,
Ruby,
2, 3.
Ruby got named arguments in like Ruby 3, 5.
Got it.
Or 4, 2. I don't remember exactly, but... Not like quarks.
It's pretty sweet because it lets you do like one of the I find to be like best architectural uses of quarks in Python has been Python's ORM or Django's ORM, where everything takes there's all these chainable methods when you're interacting with the database that take keyword arguments, take named arguments. So you know, ID equals 7 gets translated into, you know, like a select from where ID equals 7. But you can use all of the stuff for Python dictionaries, like a hash in any other language. You get all the benefits of hashes that you can use to compose those arguments, right? So you can write a bunch of logic that builds out all of these complex systems of arguments that you want to pass into a function call, and you get all the dictionary niceness, and then you say, hey, call this method and just go ahead and inflate this hash into the actual arguments, the keyword arguments that are being called. And it's pretty sweet.
One of my favorite features of Python so far is the decorators.
Decorators are cool, but they're fucking hard to write. Like they're fun to call though.
Yeah.
Other people's decorators.
It's a function that returns a function, and there's the func tools module that gives you some like decorator composition tools, but it still is a kind of a mind fuck.
I'm not sure how it's hard a stretch, they are to write in Java either, but I noticed when I was playing around with Spring Boot, it is adopted the decorators like all over the place.
You just go,
this is a controller and this class is now a controller.
And don't you have decorators is there decorators in like ECMAScript 2035 or whatever the fuck?
No.
I think there's
a proposed decorator syntax. I don't know. I know it's called decorators. I don't know if
I blame what do I know that from? It's not, MobX?
MobX
is the one that, uses.
Certainly blame Angular for that.
Is it like a Python decorator?
I don't know. Like,
there are other languages
if it actually
that
is a wrapper function, but I think it is.
Okay.
Because that's what I know MobX uses them for. Like, it would be a way to define the type of whatever these state properties are.
There are other languages that have constructs called decorators that aren't at all wrapped functions, and it's very confusing. I can't remember which one it is, but I've seen it before, and I was like, that's not a decorator. I'm calling a decorator. But I'm probably the wrong one there.
I like that you can... Python obviously is an object-oriented language, but you can also... I like how you can also have a file that's kind of an encompassing module, and you can just have standalone functions that are your decorator functions.
Yep.
Or you could also have a class that's a decorator class.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And you can decorate classes, or you can decorate functions.
You can decorate methods within a class.
Yeah, like, you could have a class that's a decorator, but it be kind of the hidden implementation, and then have an API function that's the decorator function, and it just passes along to the decorator class, right? Just kind of hiding it. I like that kind of separation of concerns, and how if you just need something quick, there's not too much to it, then you just have a function, and if you need something a little more complex, you can make a class.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. I think that's cool.
It's uh, there's a lot of similarities. There's definitely some different things. I feel like this is I'm gonna bundle up what I feel like the overall theme of what we discovered in talking about this, which is that there's a lot of stuff in Python that there are analogs for in Ruby. There's a lot of stuff in Ruby that there simply are not analogs for in Python. Is that accurate? Is that right?
Yeah.
I don't think there's much that Python has that you just don't have in Ruby, except for quarks, maybe.
Right.
That's what I was going to...
And decorators.
Kind of along those lines, I was going to ask, what were the things, since you've been working through the transition, so to speak, what are the things you find yourself Googling, like Python version of, or like... this in Python. Like
Python,
what are the Ruby tools or equivalents? Like, what do you find yourself searching for there? What are some things you've searched for that? Like, basically,
am I allowed to curse on the show?
Sure,
man.
Fuck no, you can't. Yeah.
God damn it,
motherfucking array methods. Flatten.
That's right.
There's no flatten.
No, you
push.
Use a fancy list comprehension.
That's right. No, yeah, no pushing and popping.
Yeah,
that's right.
And
well, you can pop, but
also
can't push.
You can pop, you can't push. We talked about this last night.
I remember I wrote this one function where I needed there was an API that could take either a string or it could take an array of multiple strings. Mm. So in Ruby,
that sounds like good. Duck typing to me.
Yeah, exactly. So my knee-jerk reaction is, okay, well, I'll make a Ruby. I do in Ruby, I would just cast the string to an array, right? If it's an array and I cast it to an array, it'll just stay the same. And if it's a string, then now it's an array with one object in it. But in Python, when you cast a string to an array,
splits the string.
It splits it.
Yeah, you get a list of characters when you do that.
Right,
yeah.
Which I would only expect if I would call split on a string and not cast. So then I was like, how do I do that? And it seems like the solution is to put the string in double brackets in Python. Like you just put double brackets around the variable name. But then that doesn't really do it if you have...
That is a list comprehension that is yielding a list that has one item in it.
Yeah.
So it's it's just exploiting list comprehension syntax, I think. I've never seen double brackets like that before.
Interesting. Yeah.
I'm trying to think because that gets confusing with sets, right? But empty brackets is a dictionary.
Python sets are this like weird thing that with this forgotten about corner of the code that's like, hey, here's don't forget about sets. They work kind of like lists, but they do this and like they share syntax with everything. And depending on what fucking mood the interpreter's
they're immutable. Like that's the only thing you get from a set.
They're immutable and you can't have duplicates.
Yeah, right? Exactly. So it can be useful like that.
Totally. The easiest way to remove duplicates from a list is just call set.
Definitely.
Just like, and then you could cast it back.
That's
to
literally
a list
all you. That's all I ever use set for.
I have written a lot of code that does list, set, list, and then some other thing that I'm casting to a list. So it's like I need to take this Django query set, cast it to a list, remove duplicates, and then turn it back into a list because I can't use it as a set over here or something like that. But then there's like weird shit where using parentheses. In Python, it's like, I'm not totally sure if I'm building a tuple. I'm not totally sure if I'm creating a generator or if this is going to be a set somehow when it's all said and done.
Because you also don't need the parentheses for a tuple. You can just comma.
That's right.
Just the single comma.
And if you want a single item tuple, you need the parentheses and you need to throw a comma at the end of it.
If there's not a comma at the end,
otherwise, what have you created? Like a one item set, right? Yeah. Or something. Yeah.
I've done that several times.
So this is a problem of just like, hey, remember those parentheses? Let's just fucking work them over because we don't use them. We don't use them in like for loops and stuff like that. So we felt like we could get more miles out of those parentheses. So we used them for everything. I didn't design the language.
That was a solution in need of a problem.
Yeah, something along those lines. But yeah, I think that's pretty interesting because I kind of felt like that was the case, that there were just weren't a whole lot of things that Python had that Ruby didn't. So I don't know what that means. There's no big takeaway there. That's just an observation from this conversation.
I would say that I used to think Ruby was certainly a better language to learn as a beginner, which is very obvious opinion to have as somebody who only knows one of the two languages. Right. But now that I've been learning Python as well, I think Python is significantly less complicated than Ruby. When you take everything into consideration, there's just less stuff. There's less weird stuff, like the count in calling dot count on an array in Ruby. Ruby certainly takes duck typing to the extreme. So you have one function that does something different depending on how many arguments you pass to it or what type of argument you pass to it.
Right.
And Python will give you a different function.
So that's something that I think is kind of systemic in the culture of the language, if you will, and kind of the philosophy and design. The reason why you can't find an easy method that will either leave a list to list or convert a string to a list with one string in it is because in Python, I feel like it would be really frowned upon to have a method that accepts an argument that's either a list or a string.
Yeah.
Because it's just like, well, which is it? Is it a list or a string? You know,
It's functional in that sense, right?
Right.
Where you should have this one function takes this one type of argument and returns this one type of value every time. And it's always that.
It does. There's stuff in Python. There's a lot of stuff that's falsy values. This might return a string or none. Mm-hmm. Okay. And none's not actually an empty string. Those are two different things.
Yes, of course.
Right.
Of course.
So there's plenty of weird stuff like that. But the idea of this might return a Boolean or the letter F is no, thank you.
That's another thing. In Python, the casting, I definitely feel the casting is different because in Ruby, you have nil, which is the none equivalent. Mm-hmm. But nil, you can cast to any type that you want. Mm-hmm. If you cast nil to an array, it's an empty array. Mm-hmm. Nil to a string is an empty string. Nil to an integer is zero.
And in Python, all you get is just a fuck ton of, what is it, value errors?
Yeah, error. You get errors. Yeah. You can cast none to
none
a string.
None is pointing to one thing in memory, and that's it.
None type has no method, blah, is something you see all the time.
Yeah. But you have, if you call string on none, then you get the word none in a string.
Yeah.
But in Ruby,
that's one of the what the fuck Pythons, the PHP with two, the PHP hammer with two claws on it. That's that's one of Python's one is the string of none. Yeah.
Yeah. If you, and what I think one thing that makes Ruby a little more complicated in that regard is with Python, you would just, if you were learning Python from scratch, you would just learn, you can't cast things like that and you shouldn't cast things like that. Hmm. But in Ruby, there's actually two different kinds of casting methods. You have things like two string, but then you have two S, which will do things like that. But then you also have two STR, which does something different and would actually take nil. And I believe it turns it into a nil class in string, I believe.
Interesting.
But there's...
So that's if you go back, if you import this again, there should be one and preferably only one correct way to do it. That's part of in the philosophy of Python is even if they do two different things, it gets frowned upon to have these two things are too easy to conflate with one another.
Yeah. There's the two S, two string. There's two I, two int.
Yeah.
Two A and two array. They do slightly different things.
My blood pressure's going up right now. This is I'm not liking this.
Yeah. I'm just over here it's not none. It's not none. It's not none.
it's been a lot of fun talking about it. You know, we've done some language comparisons with Blake, but it's mostly us taking turns slapping at it like a slap fight.
Just shitting on JavaScript.
Yeah, shitting on JavaScript really. But
why'd you put it on the server?
It was nice. It was nice to have a worthy adversary today.
Sorry, Blake.
Not Blake. Ruby. Ruby. Not Blake. That sounded way worse than it was supposed to be. Blake, come back. I'm sorry.
We're sorry. We love you.
We didn't mean what we said. We'll see you guys in a week. Have a good one.
Thanks for listening to Friday Afternoon Deploy, recorded and produced by the team at Lofty Labs.
If you enjoyed the show, you can subscribe to future episodes via iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spotify. You can also follow at Friday Deploy on Facebook and Twitter for episode previews, live streams, and other behind-the-scenes peeks. Past episodes and show notes on this episode can be found at friday.hirelofty.com. That's friday.hirelofty.com. If you'd like to contact the show, or if you're local to the Northwest Arkansas area and would like to be a guest on the show, you can email us at podcast@hirelofty.com.